The Guardian.
Hello and thanks for taking the time to listen. I'm Sean McGinty and I'm your host for the Guardian Social Enterprise Network podcast. This is podcast number 8. Coming up this month, we immerse ourselves in the world of cooperatives and we hear from a president.
If a cooperative ever gets into difficulty, it's because they've forgotten their members. And so the core thing for us is to keep our members active, and that's what we're doing.
That's the president of the International Cooperative Alliance, Dame Pauline Green. Also coming up, the risks ahead as local services move out of the public sector.
Commissioners can make catastrophically bad decisions, and unfortunately in this transition period some of those decisions might be permanent.
Alison Ogden-Newton from the Transition Institute, a body dedicated to finding the best ways of spinning out public services. And we'll hear how the cooperative movement is playing its part in the transformation of our local health and council services.
Communities right across the whole of the UK are turning to cooperative solutions for the provision of their local businesses and services.
That's Angela Davies from the Co-op in the UK. More from her later in the podcast.
The Guardian.
So this month, we're all about cooperatives, which you could easily describe as the Northwest's, all right, the UK's most successful worldwide export. Here's some numbers for you. Since 2008, GDP in the UK is 1.7% lower, whilst the turnover of the cooperative economy has grown by 19.5%. UK cooperatives turn over £35.6 billion every year. And worldwide, the largest 300 cooperatives together turned over $1.6 trillion, which if it was a country would make it the ninth largest country in the world by gross domestic product. So that's the scale and reach both here in the UK and worldwide. But what of the new cooperatives that are leaping out of the public sector almost every day? What challenges and opportunities are they now weighing up? Well, to explore this, I spoke with Alison Ogden-Newton from the Transition Institute and Andrew Burnell from the City Healthcare Partnership. I asked Alison first to explain what her organisation does.
The Transition Institute is a platform to support and promote new forms of public service delivery that look at social value and have that as their central aim. So the good guys, really.
Now, when you say social value, how do we define that? What is that?
Social value is something actually that needs a more concrete definition, and that's something the Institute's looking at. But generally, if you look at the recently introduced social value legislation, it is the notion that, for instance, employee participation, community engagement, sort of cooperative distribution of profit, and generally an organisation that's focused on the benefit of the many rather than the few, is a preferential way to go about delivering public services than straightforward privatisation, as most of us would know it.
The word transitioning, I mean, it's quite a horrible word, but I think we all know what it means now. To some people, from a political perspective, what we're talking about is privatising public services. What do you say to that, Alison?
You're absolutely right. The transition is all things to all people, but we think it's a very important term because what could happen, and I think this is a fear that a lot of people share, and we do as well, what could happen is that in the rush to save money and capitalise public services, there could be a wholesale outsourcing of contracts to companies that are almost exclusively in a position to pick those contracts up because they have the capital already or because they have the capacity. And what we don't want to see happen is all that is good about public services, public service ethic, employee engagement, people who are motivated by what they do for the sake of doing it. We don't want to see that and the public's participation within public services and their approval of it go by the wayside, because I think, as we know from past privatisation phases, once you've sold the family silver, you don't get it back again.
Now, we're talking about co-ops in this podcast. How many co-ops do you see out there doing this?
Co-ops are, you know, they're a bit like icebergs. There is an enormous cooperative movement in this country that's sort of under the waterline. Mm. When you look at, for instance, things like the farming sector, the largest single contributed to British farming are farming co-ops. They contribute hugely to the economy. So when you think about cooperatives delivering public services, for those that are familiar with the cooperative world, that isn't much of a stretch at all. But when we look at public services, particularly those that currently exist very much in the more traditional form, reconfiguring themselves as employee-led organisations, we're looking at something more like the kind of organisation Andrew runs, which is a mutual that overtly involves employees, giving them a stake in the organisation that they then deliver for the benefit of the public.
Well, Alison, demonstrating you've done this before, let's throw this to Andrew. Your City Healthcare partnership, how did you end up with the kind of model you have, which has some mutual sort of aspects to it?
For us, I mean, I, you know, 26 years probably then in the NHS. I mean, one of the values and worth about people that do join such an organisation is that they do sign up to that sort of like the moral, the value, and the belief that there's something behind what you do when you come to work. But actually, it's inevitably the system that sort of like dismantles that by the nature of the way that the whole of that sort of like large public sector is set up. So for us, one of the things that, well, for me, one of the things that became apparent early on in the transition from the NHS into this into our community interest company, it was how are we going to get that, you know, that extra mile, that extra buy-in? And it just became apparent that there was this movement out there, you know, like the co-ops, but also like the employer ownership association, like others, where entrepreneurial individuals had given up big chunks of their business to the staff, and that actually what you were seeing through the evidence base way back then, that was over sort of like six and a half years ago, was that those organisations were bucking the trend in terms of downturn, but also were getting some fantastic results in terms of employee satisfaction.
Do you also sort of unlock a world of pain for a chief executive where you've got staff that are going, I don't want shares, I'm happy where I am. This is a public service. What do you mean we're going to be outside of the public sector?
There was a lot of pain in getting to where we were, but that pain has dissipated, and actually we're in a better place now than we would have been if we stayed within the NHS. And I think a great number of the staff, they see that now, and actually having sort of like some self-determination in their ability to be able to drive care and quality and be engaged and to actually make decisions and to influence those decisions is a powerful tool in understanding how we can survive trying and testing times now and in the future.
Andrew, you're in a good place, staff and patient-wise. Now, do you just sit there and go, OK, we've got the business we've got from the places we get it from the NHS, I take it, or are you looking at other ways of supplementing your income and growing? And what
grown.
Areas are, though?
We've grown since going live. We came out of the NHS at approximately around about £47 million. We're now 50... I think it's nearly 51, and we've diversified. We've done a 100% share acquisition of a for-profit business locally. We're just looking at other acquisitions, and some of them are nearing fruition. We're in partnerships locally with other sort of like private sector, voluntary sector organisations. We've won numerous tenders recently for business outside the area. You know, we are looking where it fits with our. You know, where it does fit with our raison d'etre to look at that, but also try and really create stronger partnerships with other providers to deliver care. So we're delivering a lot more integrated care with the local authority than we were, and we recently sort of been successful in winning a tender to provide carer services in Hull, which has been predominantly, so like the last 13 years, stuck within another type of organisation. But we've now managed to link that through to our wider resource and are turning that round to be, you know, to demonstrate that we can do it.
Alison, the C word has come up, commissioners. Are they the ones that are really, really difficult? I mean, it sounds like Andrew's got, you know, certainly got his business sorted out, and the commissioners where he is sees what he does and sees the social value. But is it a lack of education from the commissioners that in many other areas they don't get it yet?
This is a really, really big job. It's easy to set up commissioners as sort of straw men and you know, try and knock them down. The problem is that commissioners have a very clear job, which is to find the cheapest possible service. What we need to do is yes, as you quite rightly say, educate them about the alternatives, looking at employee ownership, looking at cooperatives, looking at mutuals, looking at social enterprises. And at the same time, we need to help them, even if they don't think they need the help, to create the political framework to make some of those choices acceptable. At the moment, you've got commissioners who are being directed by their lords and masters to, for instance, introduce capital bonds within a commissioning framework. Capital bonds almost certainly will exclude any organisation for whom the ownership of capital is precluded by their governance model.
Yeah.
Now, we have to make a decision as a public, and it's a difficult decision because it's a little bit complicated. Do we want to create asset locks within the new models for public service delivery, the sort of thing that Andrew's talked about, in which case we're not selling the family silver, we are genuinely looking at radical and innovative ways of delivering the service which engages more people in a better service? Or are we going to essentially outsource the services along with all their capital value, along with all their assets, once and for all, for companies that clearly disassociate their management of profit and finance between that and their service deliverers? You've got companies tendering for public sector services that have no experience in delivering those services whatsoever. They merely have access to capital, and winning those contracts in preference to long-standing community-based organisations with the kind of pedigree and the kind of thought and engagement that we're talking about today and we're saying is preferable. So yes, I mean, commissioners can make catastrophically bad decisions. And unfortunately, in this transition period, some of those decisions might be permanent. And that's why we're sort of banging the drum and getting on the table and being noisy and sort of saying, you know, and entering what is a fairly difficult middle ground between people who don't want their public services touched. And we're saying actually there are alternatives, there are better ways of doing this. They could be more efficient, they could be more cost effective, but they also need to change in a way that continues to be recognisable to the public as a public service. And we need to lock that value into the delivery and not allow it to seep out into shareholder value where we might never see it again. And that is a moment in time, if you like, which is why we think that the next couple of years are going to be absolutely critical to the way in which public services change. And the government and local authorities and commissioning authorities can go one way or they can go another.
That's Alison Ogden-Newton from the Transition Institute and Andrew Bennell from City Healthcare Partnership talking about the challenges facing public services as they move into new ownership models. This is the Guardian Social Enterprise Podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. It was a business revolution that started in Rochdale on December the 21st, 1844, and now involves a billion people as members of 1.4 million cooperative societies around the world. Pauline Green is the president of the International Cooperative Alliance, and Gisbert Heijink is from Som Energia, which is a renewable energy cooperative in Spain. So these so-called cooperators, they're all over the world then.
They certainly are. In fact, arguably, it's the best ever export from the UK to help combat poverty around the world, because the co-op movement now across the world is owned by over a billion people worldwide. We employ over 100 million citizens of the world, and our top largest 300 cooperatives, and we've got many, many hundreds and hundreds of thousands, but our largest 300 are worth $1.6 trillion. That's the equivalent to the ninth largest economy of the world. So just to be a bit flippant, we should be in the G20, really, as a model of business.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, what sort of areas, what are the big areas around the world where co-ops, you know, where people come together in cooperatives?
Oh, well, they're in so many different sectors of the economy. The big, most traditional, largest ones are certainly consumer cooperatives, the shops, banking, insurance, agriculture, of course, which is very big, housing, health, a range of areas across the world. And our largest 300 co-ops, for instance, are from 25 different countries. So we've got a fair spread across the world. And wherever you can make a business case for a cooperative, you'll find them. Different countries have focused on different things because of tradition and history, but they're in so many different sectors of the economy.
Heisbert, let's talk about Som Energia. Now, you're based in Spain. You are a cooperative. What do you do there?
We are a renewable energy production and consumption cooperative. So we sell electricity to our members, which is certified green electricity. And our aim is that all the electricity that our members buy comes from our own renewable energy projects.
Okay, and how's it gone down in Spain? I mean, what's the sort of culture like? Is there a cooperative culture in Spain?
Yeah, there's quite a strong cooperative culture. There are a few very big ones like Mondragon, which is I think world famous, and here in the area of Catalonia, there's a few very big supermarket cooperatives. There is a very big bookshop called Abacus, and there are many farmer agricultural cooperatives. There are cooperative banks. So there's quite a big sector.
Mm. Now, why did you go the cooperative route?
Because when I started thinking about it with some friends, our aim was and is to change the energy sector from the current fossil fuel-based and polluting to a more sustainable system. And we thought we needed a lot of implication, a lot of people with let's say, real interest and real involvement. And after looking at various different business models which we could take, we thought this would be by far the best. And I think the success that we have, and we've grown in 1.5 years from 300 members to almost 3,500. Mm. Has shown that we took the right road.
Now, Pauline, does the membership model, though, really address some of the sort of fast-paced business issues we've got now? You know, like rapidly changing technology, we've got low rates of growth, and businesses really need to respond quickly. Can a cooperative do that?
Well, you know, there's this sort of image of a cooperative that it doesn't, but in fact it's completely false. By the way, the energy cooperatives, which you've just been hearing so well about in Spain, are one of the most rapidly growing forms of cooperative across the world. This new wave of cooperatives doing exactly what you were just saying can cooperatives do, which is respond to the world's needs. The critical thing about a cooperative is that it responds to local needs, local culture and member demands. So when you get a demand from members like, why don't we look after our own energy here? We want a renewable, a green energy here. Then a cooperative can respond and does respond. So even now in the world of financial collapse that we're seeing over the last 4 or 5 years, financial co-ops have been doing incredibly well because they've been, as money's been withdrawn from the large corporate commercial bankers, they've been turning to the mutual and cooperative bankers and insurers and credit unions. And tens of thousands of people are changing their bank accounts to credit unions and cooperative banks. So yes, we are able to respond, and yes, we do respond. People realise that collectively you're more comfortable, you're safer, it's more sustainable, and it's a model of business that we think people like. And they're turning to.
Now, you will see hundreds of different, not necessarily models, but different types of cooperative organisations around the world in your role as president of the International Cooperative Alliance. Is there one that you've seen that you could have sort of give us an example of the kind of work worldwide that, as you said earlier, that we've sort of exported?
Well, let's talk about India, which of course now is an emerging or an airplane economy, but has been still has a lot of real poverty to deal with. And one of the great successes of cooperation in India was the Gujarat Milk Marketing Board, which turned into a very successful, huge global dairy cooperative, which now supplies, it's the biggest brand name in India. It's beaten Nestle and all the other traditional brands into a cocked hat, and it's now the most recognised brand in India, Amul. And it supplies milk and milk products not only right across India, but to the United States and to Australia and to South Africa. It's a huge, and it's providing the living for 3 million dairy farmers across India. I mean, that's why we have 1 billion people owning co-ops across the world, because it's sustaining their lives. And the UN has said that cooperatives protect the living standards of half the world's population. So, of course, people want to be part of a cooperative. It's about them. The key difference is that our model of business is actually people-based, people-centred. It's not profit-centred. So people are at the heart of our decision-making. Our duty constitutionally is to provide a good service to our members. Mm. That's why a cooperative is so appealing.
Do you ever sort of, you know, you're in the pub, you're relaxing with friends, and you probably go on at them about cooperatives. And so they perhaps know about it, and I'm sure you will. But does it frustrate you that it's almost like a silent revolution going on here?
That's the value of the International Year, you know. This is what the UN have given us, this really rich gift of the International Year of Co-ops. And I have to tell you, because I've been going around 3.5 weeks out of every month, I'm on the road looking at co-ops around the world. And there's never been a period when the cooperatives globally have been so cohesive. They've all responded, they've all coalesced around the International Year logo and slogan that the UN has given us. And there's suddenly an awakening of just how big they are across the world together. Mm. But at the same time, each cooperative is local, owned locally by local people, and it's autonomous and it's independent. So one of our problems is that we are not a traditional brand like a stock market brand that you would recognise, one of the big ones, because all our businesses have different names. What unites us is a set of principles and values and a different way of doing business, just as Heisberg was saying. It's about looking after people. It's changing the world. That's what the UN says. Cooperative enterprises help to build a better world. And that's what we're about. Mm. And that's what unites us. So we don't want to be a great global brand. We want to change the global economy, create a fairer global economy, one that people can engage in. Look at the way the kids in the Occupy movement were so cynical about the world, and both politically and economically, in which they live. Mm. We think that the cooperative model's got something different to offer, something that they can take part in, they can have an impact on, and they can make it their own.
Heisberg, I mean, that's clearly sort of the direction from which you're coming. When you look at a business you're doing in Spain, what's the opportunity for you doing business with other cooperatives?
What we're seeing is that our success has already sparked the setup of two new cooperatives in other areas of Spain. And I'm sure that in 5 years from now, there will be at least 10 cooperatives like ours in Spain, because you need this local component also. And what next weekend we will meet with 150 of our members over in a location in Spain to decide on our future organization and how we can work together.
Right. Do you know, it's interesting. That was one of my other questions I was going to ask. How do you deal with a membership of 150 and come up with some sort of coherent plan for your future?
Well, we will see. We're trying to find out. When we started, we were quite small, and the whole internal organization was set up for that. So we have a membership assembly which decides on all the major issues, and then we have a board who decides on all the daily issues. But now we're getting really big, and we probably have to reorganize in regional groups. And we're gonna see what is the best way to do that. If Pauline has any suggestions of other cooperatives that we should look at, I'll be happy to hear about it.
Yeah, Pauline, I mean, I was going to ask you the same question. How do cooperatives around the world sort of deal with it? It's great having members, because that's a power, yes, isn't it? But how do you sort of get all those different views into some sort of coherent strategy?
Well, you know, the members are the owners, so we've got to get all those different views into a coherent strategy. And the best are brilliant. If you look at the cooperative group here in the UK, they're an excellent example of how you can reach out to all your members. 6 million, I think, they're working with. And they reach out across the country. They've got small groups around the country. Then they've got larger regional groups. They pull them together using new technology, using local centred groups around stores, any sort of innovative way. They've got a very active policy, and those members now dictate the social agenda for the cooperative group in the coming years. They'll say what are their main objectives, and the group will pursue the three or four major objectives that the members are putting to them in a national survey. The key thing about a cooperative is that if a cooperative ever gets into difficulty, it's because they've forgotten their members. And so the core thing for us is to keep our members active, and that's what we're doing.
I was speaking there to Dame Pauline Green, the president of the International Cooperative Alliance, and Gisbert Hijink from Som Energia, which is a renewable energy cooperative in Spain. Any thoughts you've got on the podcast will be gratefully accepted. You can tweet us at Guardian Sockent or at Sean A. McGinty. And do please find your way to socialenterprise.guardian.co.uk and join the Guardian Social Enterprise Network. So what about the UK cooperative movement? Now, how's that faring? A radically changing landscape for public services brings both opportunities and threats in abundance. So I spoke with Angela Davis. She's the Cooperative Development Manager at the Cooperative Group. And I asked her if they think about the future.
Yes, we're very much about the future. The Cooperative Group is a unique family of businesses and is also the largest cooperative in the UK. And as such, we want to put our money where our mouth is, so to speak, by investing in the wider cooperative sector.
And how do you do that then?
Well, over the next 3 years, we'll be investing £6 million through the Cooperative Enterprise Hub. And this is a unique UK-wide support programme for cooperative enterprises. It operates through a national network of regional development workers who manage the hub at a local level.
You're looking at investing some money in other co-ops. Why are you doing that? It's just out of generosity and largesse?
Well, one of the key principles of cooperatives is cooperation amongst co-ops. So we have an interest, if you like, to support the wider cooperative sector. And one way to do this is through the Cooperative Enterprise Hub. And we do other things as well, but this is where the main investment is being put into.
Is it now sort of thing in the, you know, post-banking crash and we're in the middle of austerity measures all around the world and, you know, the world economy is in a mess. Is this the time for the co-op?
Absolutely. I think that what we're seeing through the enterprise is communities right across the whole of the UK are turning to cooperative solutions for the provision of their local businesses and services. And these businesses are operated by ordinary people who are increasingly concerned about the environment, community cohesion, and how business is organised.
So what about young people? How do they get involved? This seems sort of, co-ops seem complicated. How do you get young people involved in them?
Well, co-ops can be complicated, but the Enterprise Hub and the consultants that we work with will work with a local group to take them through all the issues that they need to deal with. We will help them with writing their business plan and all the legal and governance issues associated with that. So don't be put off by co-ops being complicated, because it isn't necessarily the case. What we want to do in the future is encourage the next generation of cooperators. We want to encourage young people to set up their own businesses. You know, young people leaving university now, a number of them are not going into full-time employment. So we will be targeting young people of this nature to say, well, a cooperative business might be a solution for you with some of the people who you know. So, for example, we are seeing music groups coming together, theatre groups coming together, disadvantaged young people who are providing domestic services in their local community to members of the community, and they're doing this in a cooperative way.
This is the Guardian Social Enterprise Podcast, and I'm Sean McGinty. And finally, Esther, in this, the UN International Year of the Cooperative, a final swan song for this year's events is coming up in Manchester. I'll give you details of that shortly. So how did this Year of the Co-op come about? I asked Giles Simon from Cooperatives UK.
The International Year was a kind of the brainchild of the International Cooperative Alliance, which is the umbrella body organisation for cooperatives around the world. And it had worked closely with the United Nations, largely over a kind of a four-year period, to try and establish an international year when we can kind of look at how cooperatives around the world are doing lots of good things to relieve poverty, to kind of help people into work and into jobs, and to kind of provide livelihoods for people all over the world. So it was a kind of something initiated by the International Cooperative Alliance, and the UN agreed that this was a great thing to do, and so kind of 2012 became the International Year of Cooperatives.
Now let's look at Cooperatives United. I mean, it's kind of as yet head towards the end of the International Year of Cooperatives. There's an event in Manchester. What are you hoping to achieve there?
Looking at the year as a whole, the International Year of Cooperatives has kind of been a year of, in a way, celebration of cooperatives and also a kind of campaigning for building a more cooperative economy and a different way of organising the economy over across the whole world. The year itself was launched at the United Nations kind of in late 2011, really. And so it was opened there. There was a big group of cooperators from around the world who kind of went to the UN headquarters in New York. And the Manchester event is in a way seen as the kind of the closing event of the international year, if you like. It's the culmination of everything that people have been doing to campaign and raise awareness of the cooperative way of doing things.
I mean, it's many years on, isn't it? But it feels like it's the cooperative movement sort of at the age of, I don't know,
the odd years,
160
really,
years, yeah. But it's kind of coming of age now. I mean, it feels that in public services here in the UK, in other areas, addressing issues, and certainly around the world in terms of energy, the cooperative movement sort of getting a little bit more confident.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think it is very much becoming more confident, and that is a consequence of, in a way, it's a consequence of what's been going on over the last few years, and the fact that cooperatives have kind of performed differently over the last few years, whereas other businesses have been struggling, cooperatives have been doing quite well, and kind of across the world, particularly in the UK, but also everywhere in the world, really, we've seen cooperatives performing very strongly and commercially doing well when others are struggling. And kind of Cooperatives United is very much about that celebration. So, you know, on the Wednesday of, you've got this kind of big trade exhibition celebrating what's going on. On the Wednesday, we've got a big international kind of event with 800 people likely to be kind of voting and talking about what the cooperative decade might look like, or what our cooperative decade might look like over the next 10 years or so. On the Thursday, we've got kind of a big cooperative congress where we're bringing together people who have been running the campaigns in the States to get people to shift their money and move their money to more ethical providers and big providers of kind of finance in various different places. And they're all kind of coming together in a way to share what's been working and to celebrate the fact that finally, I guess, cooperatives are being seen as the kind of the sustainable and successful way of doing business that they are.
Thanks to Giles Simon from Cooperatives UK for talking me through the international year and that Cooperatives United event. And if you fancy going to that, just go to manchester2012.coop and all the details are there. It runs from the 29th of October to the 2nd of November and looks like it'll be a great place for networking with and learning from the worldwide cooperative movement. So here's how you can get in touch. You can email me, me at seanmcginty.co.uk, or you can email my editor, David Mills. That's david.mills@guardian.co.uk. Please also go to socialenterprise.guardian.co.uk and make your thoughts known on this podcast and all the other fabulous content you'll find on there too. If you're on Twitter, please tweet your thoughts to @GuardianSockEnt, or for my personal Twitter, it's @SeanAMcGinty. And please remember also to share us with your friends and colleagues in the usual way. I'm Sean McGinty. Thanks for listening, and see you next time for more news, comment and information from the Guardian Social Enterprise Network. You should join it. It's free.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.